right, folks, welcome to another edition of Stranger in a Southern Land. I, of course, am your host, Jake Manning. Today on the program, I speak with Scott Maitland of Topo Distillery, also from Top of the Hill Brewery and Restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. You know, I thought I was just sitting down with a distillery owner, but turns out I was sitting down with an entrepreneur, a visionary, an innovator, and a veteran. You know, this conversation had far more levels to it than I thought it ever would. And Scott was just such a great guy to talk to. Just very open, just very cool, you know, very direct, and just gave me a wealth of knowledge, especially about whiskey. What an education I got from that guy. I said, you know, take me far back as you know, and he went all the way back to the 1800s. Gosh, he was far better than some of the bourbon tours I took in Kentucky, that's for sure. So can't thank him enough for sitting down and talking to me, because he's a very busy man and he's a very gracious man. Of course, he gave me a bottle of his, you know, Eight Oak whiskey, which I can't wait to jump into. I kind of save it for when Sojo gets back in town. She's on a business trip right now. So, you know, share it with my girlfriend, share it with my lady, because it's good quality whiskey and it's made by a good man. So very excited to bring this conversation to you with Scott from Topo Distillery, but I'm also very excited and very happy and very pleased to be part of the Shining Wizards Podcast Network. Great guys over there. They're trying to expand this podcast in a different market and different earbuds. So make sure you look them up at shiningwizardsnetwork.com. Also, too, big thank you to my producer, Don, as always. Make sure you look at all the other podcasts that he produces at dsct.tv, as well as, you know, How Did This Get Booked, which is another podcast that I do with Zane Riley. So make sure you log on to that website for more information about that. That or howdidthisgetbooked.com. Either one, it'll lead you there. But anyways, folks, happy to report that I survived the title versus career match. I'm pretty excited to be started announcing some wrestling dates and stuff like that. They're coming in pretty fast. I've got kind of limited information about that. I'm not too sure in the towns, but what I can tell you is I will be performing for Northeast Wrestling this Saturday, July 30th. I believe it's in the Rockland area. For more information about that show, make sure you log on to northeastwrestling.com. Like I said, it's been kind of hazy. I'm just trying to get it all situated and confirm everything. I can be there now that my career can continue. Also, too, I will be helping out Sojo. Like I said, she's out of town right now, but when she comes back, she's definitely going to be in town for Saturday, August 6th, Queens of Combat, and that will they will be holding a show at the Mid-Atlantic Fan Fest here in Charlotte at the University Hilton here in Charlotte. It used to be NWA Fan Fest, but now it is Mid-Atlantic Fan Fest, but for more information about the Queens of Combat show, make sure you log on to combatqueens.com. Then, August 19th and 20th, I will be at the Executive Park Hilton performing at Bonkers again that Friday and Saturday. For more information about those shows, make sure you log on to Bonkers Comedy Productions, Bonkers with a Z, because they're bonkers. And then the last weekend of August, this is confirmed, I'm very excited about this, a lot of ballpark shows. I'll be making my debut in Bethany for Northeast Wrestling, and that's the weekend of August 26th, 27th, and 28th. 28th is a Sunday, and that is in Bethany. 27th, I believe, is at the Dutchess Stadium up around Fishkill, New York. Like I said, it's kind of a haze right now. I can now confirm these shows, so I'm very excited about that. And then, of course, the 26th, I believe, is in Massachusetts. But the way you can find out about that information about those shows more accurately, make sure you log on to northeastwrestling.com. Like I said, been adding these wrestling dates really fast now that I know that I confirm them. I know that I'm going to be there, and changes are going to come up all the time. But the best way for you to know about changes and more information about this show and kind of what's going on in my life and what's going on, make sure you log on to Twitter at ManScoutManning or on Instagram at ManScoutManning. If you have a question about this podcast, make sure you email me at jake@sslshow.com. Or if you want to book it for an upcoming wrestling event, and I'm so glad that you can right now, make sure you log on to, or not log on, what am I talking about here? Just email me at ManScoutManning. It's been a while since I've read that. I thought I'd have to change that copy there for a second, so I was a little nervous about that, but we're all good to go. Wrestling's a good go for me, so I'm very happy about that. But I'm more happy to produce and present to you this podcast with Scott Maitland from Topo Distillery, here on Stranger in a Southern Land.
Hey,
and it's Scott Mayton. Oh, good. Okay. I have a very tricky last name myself, so I always am very sensitive to people, but I mean, Maitland's easy.
Like an adult theme park.
Exactly. But yeah, like I'm very interested about all this, Scott, especially, you know, the distillery and stuff like that. But you even go back even further of working with breweries and stuff like that. Yep. You know, Topol's been around for a while. But, you know, talk about, like, how did this all come to be?
Sure. So I got out of the Army after Desert Storm with the firm conviction never to let somebody stupider than me be in charge of me again. And
yeah, because let's maybe talk about that too, like the Army and stuff. Like, because I was in my Army recruiter's office,
yep.
My local Army recruiter's office, and I was this close twice of joining up and enlisting. What got you enlisted, and what wanted you to?
Well, I had a great opportunity, and to this day, I don't know how this opportunity arrived. But as a senior in high school, I got contacted by the Department of the Army to show up for a physical for West Point, and I had no contact about West Point or the United States Military Academy, so I still to this day don't know how that opportunity came about. But bottom line is,
it's almost like they recruited, like, you were a basketball player for
Chapel
Hill.
Honestly, that would, like, literally, and that's a whole story in itself. We don't need to get bogged down, but I will
tell you that it
is a difficult process to get into the service academies. And I just sort of Forrest Gumped my way in.
They saw you as an individual that could do it, I guess?
No, to be fair, I still don't understand how I got this, but basically the only day I was sick my entire high school career, I get a letter from the Department of the Army saying I need to show up for a physical, and I'm thinking that I got drafted because I just signed up for selective service or whatever, and it turns out it was a physical in conjunction with West Point. And I said, well, what's that? And the guy at the hospital that I had called said, oh, it's a 4-year scholarship. And of course I'm, you know, I'm a senior in Los Angeles, and I'd gotten a small scholarship to go to UCLA, but my family didn't have any money. And the guy says, yeah, man, they pay for everything. And
that's how they get you.
Okay.
That's how they almost got me twice.
but I got to tell you, it was truly, it remains a seminal event in my life. Absolutely overjoyed that I went to the academy. It was very, very hard, but also very, very fulfilling, and the relationships I built then were fantastic. And ironically, even my frustrations with the Army as I left, I've come to realize that they are not Army-specific frustrations. They are large organization frustrations, and that, in fact, I think the Army handles those frustrations better than other large organizations that I have subsequently been involved with. So,
like, how so?
Well, I just think that, I mean, man, we can spend, no, we can fill a whole hour about Army.
This is about you.
I will tell you the specific issue about two reasons why I got out of the Army. One, you got to remember that during Desert Storm, Congress actually passed a reduction in force thing. So they were shrinking the Army because the Cold War was over. Mm-hmm. And so when Desert Storm was over, they said, hey, specifically, class of 88, you did your duty. Now do your duty and resign your commission early.
Yeah.
And I had no plans on doing that, but I was a combat engineer, and my job was to defeat minefields. And the minefields we faced in Desert Storm had magnetic fuses, and the only boots that I had been issued by the Army and my troops had been issued by the Army were jungle boots, Vietnam era jungle boots that had steel plates on the bottom that would set off the magnetic fuses. So I spent my entire time in the desert trying to get myself and my men the Desert Storm boots that were designed by Schwarzkopf. And because of the unique role that my engineer company was playing in the war, I got to go from the foxhole to the back port almost every day. And I would see all the guys that were living in condominiums in the port wearing these Desert Storm boots, but the guys in the foxholes all had jungle boots. And so I did everything I could to make that change and to get my guys' boots, and I couldn't get it to happen. And now we're leaving, fast forward a couple months, now we're leaving country, and literally the last thing before we got on the plane was the desert boot issue point. And I got so pissed, I said, I'm sorry, I said, I'm not going to take my boots. And the sergeant says, no, it's mandatory. And I said, Sergeant, last time I checked, I outrank you, you're not stopping me, right? Yeah. Next thing you know, I'm talking to a lieutenant, and I say, listen, you know, I'm not taking these. Next thing you know, I'm talking to a captain. And I said, Captain, you know, I'm not taking this. You guys didn't get these to me when I needed them. I'll be goddamned if I'm going to wear them back on the plane. So finally, I ended up talking to a colonel. I said, "Colonel, you can court-martial my ass right now, but you couldn't get these to me when I needed them. I'll be goddamned I'm going to wear them getting off the plane." And I got on the plane, and I was so pissed. And then once again, we got the whole pitch about, you know, really need to think about resigning your commission, do the, you know, country a service. And I got off that plane and said, "Well, you know what? If we're shrinking down and there's not going to be a lot of opportunity in the Army, I need to get out." So I was actually one of the first guys to get out from my class. The irony, of course, is we have been basically in a constant state of war since then. And I'm very proud of my classmates that have stayed in because they have achieved some really impressive things. In fact, one of my classmates has taken over the command of the 82nd Airborne here in 2 weeks, and another one of my classmates has taken over the 101st. And so it's been fun to see and kind of live two alternative lives. See the guys that stayed in and see how well they've done and the tremendous sacrifice and service they've done over the last 24 years. At the same time, it's been fun to, you know, do the career that I've been doing as well. And that leads me to going to law school and not knowing what I wanted to be, but knowing that I wanted to do my own business, realizing I didn't want to go start a law firm, and I also didn't want to move to Atlanta, which was what I originally thought I'd wanted to do. And so one day in the spring of 94,
I just wanted to avoid the traffic.
Yeah, honestly. So I grew up.
I was just there this weekend. Yes,
it's insane, right?
Oh, absolutely. For no reason.
The summer of 1979, I'm 14 years old, and I just gotten beat up by a Hispanic gang, and I'm walking home. It's 105 degrees, and it's smoggy as hell. And I remember being 14 years old and deciding I'm not going to stay in Southern California. I'm going to find Southern California as described by my grandparents in the 1950s. And I thought that would be Atlanta. But I realize Atlanta 1993 is too much like Southern California 1979, so I don't want to move down to Atlanta.
Like how specifically? Just
the traffic and just the whole, I could just see where it was going. And so for the end of 93 and the beginning of 94, I'm really stuck because I don't have an idea about what I want to do. And I don't know where I want to live. And I approached this, and this is one of the things I tell would-be entrepreneurs, that one of the great joys about being an entrepreneur is you get to decide where you want to live. And so instead of making it an industry-specific choice about what I was going to do, I made the decision, you know what, I'm going to stay right here in Chapel Hill. And literally a week later, they announced they were going to put a TGI Fridays, where Top of the Hill Restaurant and Brewery is now. Mm-hmm. And so I geared the remaining part of my second year in law school and the third year in law school around raising the money to support the idea of Top of the Hill Restaurant and Brewery, which ultimately got open in 1996. And my understanding is we're the fifth oldest brewery in existence in North Carolina now, but been involved with the craft beer scene, at least here in North Carolina, since the very, very beginning. And to me, micro distilling is the obvious outgrowth of that. So it's fun to have been on the ground floor of two different industries, both craft beer and micro distilling.
Okay, well, what was the foresight in that? Other than, well, I like alcohol, maybe I should make some more of it.
there was a part of that. It was funny. I'd be up at Top of the Hill, and if I had a, you know, martini or something, people would give me shit saying, "Hey, you know, you don't like drinking your own stuff." And so there was a part of me that was like, it would just be nice to be able to make liquor so I could have a mixed drink every once in a while. Mm-hmm. But the real deal is that one of the unknown facts about Top of the Hill Restaurant Brewery is that we were the second brewery in the country to put microbrewed beer in a can. We were about a week behind Oscar Blues and Dale's Pale Ale. But I didn't put the beer in a can in order to distribute it. I put the beer in a can so people would have a better package to take beer home from my restaurant. But I bought the canning machine and everything before I realized I needed to buy 165,000 cans. So next thing you know, I'm in the beer distribution business, and surprisingly, it goes very, very well, because up to that point, craft beer distribution, this is all back in 2004,
yeah.
Craft beer distribution prior to 2004 was pretty tough. And so,
like how so? Was it legal things, or was it just like access to equipment?
No, it was. There were legal issues surrounding the rights of breweries, which, by the way, I'm now fighting the same way. I'm fighting some of those same fights for micro distillers. Mm-hmm. But also there was just the sheer, you know, by law, a craft brewer had to, use a distributor back then. And then when the law changed, you could self-distribute, which was fine. There was still the issue of, you know, how do you set up the infrastructure to be able to cost-effectively distribute your product? So bottom line is that craft beer was having a hard time then. In 2004, I start putting the beer in the can. It starts going over pretty well. I immediately run out of capacity. And I think about this all the time. One of the interesting aspects of Top Hill Restaurant Brewery is we're on the third floor. And so there was no way for me to sort of expand organically, right? And so I ended up having to decide whether or not to build another brewery or not. I made that decision to build another brewery, realized the economics were going to be so much different in terms of a packaging brewery than a craft beer or brew pub that I start saying to myself, well, great, I'll have to build a really large brewery. What could I do with the excess capacity while I wait for sales and marketing to catch up? I thought, well, I could distill it. And so as a lark, I look into distilling, but then realize that, man, North Carolina, you know, I love what we've done in the beer industry in North Carolina. But the Achilles heel of the beer industry to me is that 99% of the beer made in North Carolina is made from products that come from outside of our state. That the agricultural products that are grown in North Carolina don't really lend itself well to making world-class beer. And so that was a frustration because I was also in the Chamber of Commerce and trying to figure out ways to make our state wealthier. And one of those ways is to make sure that we keep our dollars spending inside our state. And so in the process of exploring the idea of distilling, I realized that what we grow in North Carolina may not be good for making beer, but it's fantastic for making liquor. And ultimately, I pivoted, and instead of doing the canning brewery, which in retrospect, I didn't realize that I was on the hottest trend of the last 20 years, I instead decided to go ahead and do the distillery because I could use all local ingredients to do it.
Okay, so it's more of the idea of like, you know, I can get all my ingredients in state as opposed to outsourcing and stuff like
that. That's right, because again, I'm a big believer that states like us, you know, when we spend our money in North Carolina, it immediately leaves the state of North Carolina because for the vast majority of the ownership of the companies we deal with are outside our state. And local is a very, very ambiguous concept. Are you talking about locally franchised? Are you talking about all these things? So I realized that typically chambers talk about this from a business to consumer conversation. Hey, consumer, buy local. I became convinced the only way to effectively keep the money in the state was for businesses to talk to businesses about sourcing local. And I think that if businesses source local, we're going to do a lot better job of gearing up our economy. And in fact, that's happening now. We've got, you know, and I'm really, one of the things I'm really excited about is the intersection of where distilling and brewing can help each other. So not to get too far in the weeds, but one of the reasons why we grow malt barley, or we grow barley here in North Carolina, but we grow 6-row, not 2-row. And brewers want 2-row because 2-row's got less gluten in it than 6-row barley. But it turns out that the gluten in 6-row barley is not evenly distributed. 6-row barley's actually got different size barley corns, and I can't remember which one's which. I can't remember if it's the big ones have got more gluten and the small ones have the less, or vice versa. But bottom line is you can sort the barley corns that we grow in North Carolina and create a product that brewers can use because it's got lower gluten profile, and then you can give the higher gluten barley corn to distillers because gluten is not as big of an issue. And it's that kind of intersection there that makes it possible for people to start growing 6-row in North Carolina, sort it and sell it to two different industries, and then consequently have a real value add all the way up and down our supply chain. Mm-hmm. I know this is kind of boring economic
this is the type of conversation I want to have. I'm very interested in like people that start their own business and then the logistics of it. Like, yeah. I'm very interested into the early days of especially like brewing in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Now it's, you know, commonplace,
ubiquitous. Yeah.
Yeah, it's everywhere. I feel like there's one opening up in Charlotte every month.
No, and it's so funny to me because, you know, both, I think that
I'm still listening. I just got to adjust the camera work.
When you
there we go.
When you talk to, or in my mind, when I look at the impact that Carolina Brewery here in Chapel Hill, and then Top of the Hill Restaurant and Brewery, mine here, mm-hmm. we both opened up within about 6 months of each other here in Chapel Hill. But I think it's really interesting that people that are joining the industry today don't have a real appreciation of the history. And they don't realize what an important role that brew pubs like myself and Carolina Brewery played educating generations of college students coming through Chapel Hill about what craft beer is. Because, you know, if I had this conversation, I had it 1,000 times. Person walks in the Top of the Hill in 1996 and says, I'd like a Bud Light. I say, well, we're a brewery. We only sell what we make. And I'm handing them the menu, and they say, well, okay, I'll take a Coors Light. Right? And you had to explain to them that somebody actually makes beer. And I don't think that people in the industry today realize how much just basic legwork was done so that craft beer could actually start to get into a mainstream type mode. And one of the things I think that has happened in the industry at large, which I guess is a successful strategy, but I think overall is bad for craft beer, is that craft beer is starting to only market itself to craft beer enthusiasts. And I think ultimately that could be a short-sighted strategy, that we need to continue to focus hard on bringing people that aren't in craft beer. Because in as much as, you know, craft beer dominates North Carolina, you know what? Market penetration of craft beer nationwide is only 10%, right? So,
yeah.
So we've got a long way to go, and I think that one of the things that people don't really realize is that hard work of introducing people to craft beer, man, that's a tough job, and I understand why people don't want to do it. They want to rather talk to folks that already know about craft beer, but I think every brewer should make it a point that at least part of their marketing and part of their outreach needs to be to folks that haven't done craft beer at all yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not certain that's being done right now.
You just said, like, somebody would come in and, like, I want a Coors Letter. And, they, like, for me, like, it makes sense to get a craft beer because it's, like, you know, those are owned by, companies that are owned out of this country right now.
That's
you
right.
Know?
That's
and
right.
Don't you want something that's American, that's something that's made local down the street, somebody that's put some time into it? Like, basically anything you get from, like, Bud Light is just they had a huge vat and they just dumped it into this bottle and they shipped it off. And,
well, you know,
it comes all over the place. Like, don't you want something that's made local, you know?
That's right. And you're putting your finger on it. People don't understand. And I'm amazed. But even today, people still don't understand that. What does a local brewery mean? What does a, you know, I mean, I think people are starting to understand that very well. I think one of my biggest miscalculations going into the distilling industry was that I thought that we had done such good work on getting people to understand what that meant. Just like you said, well, I'd rather buy craft than local, right?
Mm-hmm.
I assume that people would then understand when we have a micro distillery, it's the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. I'm right back to where I was in 1996 with beer. I got to sit around. And I got to explain to people that alcohol or liquor is an actual agricultural product that can be made locally, that you know, it's been mass produced. And it's interesting because the liquor industry is different than beer in the sense that 7 distilleries have made over 90% of the liquor made in the United States since Alexander Hamilton. Okay, and that goes back to tax code, and Alexander Hamilton wanted to set up a tax code that favored big distillers so we can monitor the sale of alcohol to pay for our Navy and our Army, just like Britain did. And so, unlike brewing, which at one point had 5,000 breweries, funneled down to, what, under 50, and now is back out to 5,000, I kind of thought the same thing was happening in distilling. It's not true. There were never thousands and thousands of distilleries, and this is, in fact, the golden age of distilling, but I'm just surprised the consumer, how much time I have to spend on explaining to people, like, this is like craft beer, that someone has to make this, and someone has to make this locally. And not only that, we face some challenges in the liquor industry that we didn't face with beer. So good, bad, or otherwise, when I, you know, back in 1996, I put my beer on the bar against the Coors Light, you could visually see a difference. If I put my vodka against another mass-produced vodka, visually there is no difference. The other thing is that liquor companies, for the entire existence of our country, have marketed themselves as being local and produced and handmade and all this stuff, when in fact it's all been mass-produced schlock. And so, and that's not all. Okay, there are exceptions to that rule, but mm-hmm. The vast majority of it was just mass-produced. And even today, 80% of the rye whiskey made in the United States is made out of one factory in Indiana. Now, this guy makes good rye, don't get me wrong, it's great. But what happens is that hundreds and hundreds of labels buy the same rye whiskey, and then they just market it, right? And they claim that it's theirs, and they claim it's their recipe, and it's not. And so the problem is the consumer thinks that they're dealing with all these different distilleries, when in fact they're dealing with a couple of corporate conglomerations that are just sort of mass-producing stuff. And it's very difficult to get the word out that, hey, no, this is just like craft beer, that, you know, this is how we make it. There is a difference making it on a craft level. And all this other marketing that you've got, they're marketing it to make you think that they are craft folks when in fact they're not. They're just mass producing it. So it is a weird challenge, and I'm surprised. I think that's my biggest miscalculation. I thought that people would understand microdistilling more instinctively than they do.
Because you've been dealing and selling people on the idea of microbrewing for however long.
That's what I'm saying. It's right back to the future. It really is.
Well, you know, like I said, you were able to put it next to a Coors Light. And, like, see, it looks different. Like, what were some other things that you had to do to sell people just on in your microbrewing days?
Well, luckily, we had a great location. And I think one of, you know, not to toot my organization's horn, but one of the things...
Go ahead. You're on this podcast. You do what you want.
But I think,
I'm not going to stop you.
I think I took the time to do a pretty good analysis of the beer industry. And so, you know, I get inspired to do this in 1994.
How do you get an analysis of the beer industry? Drinking a lot of beer?
No. That's the interesting thing. So that's, you know, now this is no big deal. But in 1994, right, there is no AOL. There is no Google. There's none of that, right? And so being a law student, I had access to LexisNexis. And so when I got inspired to do this, I was able to go home and say, give me every newspaper article mentioning brewpub, craft beer, et cetera, for the last 5 years. And basically, that took me back to 1989 to truly, I mean, there were some early pioneers like Anchor Steam in 76 and, you know, whatever. But 89 kind of is in many ways the birth of the industry in any meaningful way. And I was able to read 850 articles from all over the country about breweries, brew pubs, and what was going on. And that gave me a big insight in terms of what was happening to the industry. And one of the things that became very apparent to me as I read about what was going on, it was that there were generations of brew pubs, even in just those 5 years. And as the laws changed, the first generation was sort of like maybe a guy that had a pizza place or something, and he's like, hey, I'm going to get the small little brewery and just kind of add on to it. Second generation was a guy that said, hey, I'm going to build a pizza place and I'm going to build a small brewery into it. And then it was third generation was like, we're going to build a brewery, and then we're going to have a little kitchen attached for food. And in my mind, the fourth generation was what interested me. And I saw a couple examples of this happening, but I realized, why are we compromising? You know, look at beer as a food, and that's what I do. I look at beer just like any other agricultural food. I look at liquor as food. I look at food as food. And so I said, well, let's have a top-notch kitchen, and let's have a top-notch brewery, and let's put that together. And there were a couple of other small folk, you know, a couple of small number of folks doing the same thing. So I like to think that, you know, from our perspective, Top of the Hill was a true fourth-generation brewpub. And so then how do we end up selling the beer? Well, because when you're in the brewpub industry, you know, you're in the restaurant business. You're not in the beer business. And I like to think of packaging breweries and brew pubs as, you know, cousins, maybe even kissing cousins. I mean, really close cousins. But the reality is the challenges that face a packaging brewery and the challenges that face a brew pub are very, very different. And so if, you know, you don't like my beer, fine, I've got other offerings to offer you. The great story, I think, with Top of the Hill was, though, is that we've always sold a tremendous amount of our beer. And I think the big decision that we made, that I made, at, quite frankly, my staff was mad at me, was to not allow the Bud Lights and the Coors Lights in the house. And when we first started, I was told by my staff, hey, this is going to mean you're going to go bankrupt because nobody wants to drink this beer that we're making. Everybody wants this other stuff. And I said, then fine, we'll go bankrupt, because I didn't start a brew pub to sell Bud Light.
Yeah.
And I even had the local Bud Light guy come and give me a hard time about that. And he said to me, this is a great place, but I'll never come back here again because you're not giving the consumers a choice. They should be able to choose whether they have Bud at your place or not. And I looked at him and I said, people can get Bud at every establishment on this street. I'm the guy that's giving them the choice, not you.
Yeah.
So if you don't want Bud, I mean, or if you do want Bud, then don't come to my place. That's the choice. And he said, I'm never going to see you again. And I said, I'm okay with that. So, and you know, but
why take such a hard line? Like, you know, some people would have compromised. What was the thing that kept you going on keeping that hard line?
Well, you know, I am very, very customer focused. But at some point, too, you know, you have to be true to the vision of what you had. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do was make and sell our own beer. So if I brought in Bud Light, you know where that's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't even going to try, and they're gonna do this other stuff. The interesting thing is, and the thing that I'm proud of, is that we continue to remain one of the best-selling independent brew pubs in the country in terms of beer sold on site. So, you know, we sell the equivalent of 2,400 barrels a year over the bar, mm-hmm. right? So that's 4,800 kegs a year just in our restaurant. And so I think that speaks highly to our beer program, and it also speaks highly to our whole operation.
Absolutely. Now, also, too, like, one thing that I've always heard about, like, in the 90s, you know, craft beer got very big, and then it shrunk. You know, it seemed like there was a short period of time there. Like, there was an explosion, very similar to what we're going through right now, kind of in the 90s, like late 90s, mid 90s.
Well, let me see if I can remember back to the 90s. I think that there were parts in the country where that was happening. You look at, you know, California and Colorado, that was starting to happen. But in North Carolina, that wasn't happening at all.
So that it was non-existent whatsoever here.
No, I mean, you think about it. I mean, you know, Highland starts in 96, the same year I start. And, it took them a good... I mean, I will tell you, the bellwether year in my mind was... Or the moment, the inflection point, was in the 2004-2005 period.
Okay.
And... and again, I'd already made at that point the decision to not do the canning brewery and instead do the distillery. And it took me, basically 7 years to get the distillery open, which is, I used to tell that story a lot, but I don't tell it anymore because it makes me cry. But I think that I didn't see what was happening. In that 2004-2005 period, things started to loosen up at the distributor level.
Mm-hmm.
And so distributors who had, mainline products that weren't doing well, specifically Coors distributors, started opening up the doors to craft breweries because they realized, hey, we need to get a better return on our distribution infrastructure. And I think it's interesting because when people walk into restaurants and they see a large craft beer section, they immediately assume that's because of the restaurant, right? I will tell you that I was there. It was the distributors. The distributors were the ones that expanded this concept of, hey, you need to have craft beers and all of that. And so in as much as craft breweries have always had a difficult relationship with distributors, in my mind, the distributors were the ones that actually really helped propel craft beer to good heights here in North Carolina. Now, I know that I'm going to have, people in the beer industry give me a lot of shit for that statement. But the reality was that they had the sales teams and they had the relationships to... And they had the vested interest to say, hey, you need to carry these other beers, right? I mean, it was kind of this radical change. It's not just going to be Bud, Miller, Coors. We're going to expand it out. Well, and I think that was a big inflection point where when the distributors came on board and started doing craft beer, then things really started getting going. And, of course, though, we still have craft beer distributor issues in North Carolina, and hopefully those aren't going to get resolved. Well, but right now, we're limited to 25,000 barrels and all of that. So
is it just regulation that's probably grandfathered in from the days of bootlegging?
Well, no, it continues to get changed. I mean, we craft breweries were not allowed to self-distribute at all. Then that law changed, and then it was 10,000 barrels, and now it's 25,000 barrels. The problem is we've got some brewers that have self-distributed and are getting close to that 25,000 barrel point. And at that point, then they'd have to bring in a distributor. Well, the way the law is written is that means they have to turn over the whole portfolio to the distributor, right? So if you jump over 25,000 barrels, that means you can't self-distribute at all anymore. Hmm. And that seems like an unfair economic burden to somebody that's built a distribution infrastructure that goes up to 25,000 barrels. So what are you supposed to do with all the trucks and all the drivers and all this kind of stuff? So hopefully the beer distributors will recognize that there should be some kind of accommodation made in that in the best interest of the citizens of North Carolina and the consumers and the breweries and the distributors that breweries should be able to keep as much of that 25,000 barrel distribution network that they set up for as long as they want. Personally, I think that breweries will then see, hey, it's a lot more effective to use the distributor as opposed to my own, but hey, that's everybody's going to make their own business decision.
Yeah, exactly. and you never want to, like I said, you got all this infrastructure. You got drivers, you got that do that, and you don't want to be laying people off just to grow your business.
That's right.
Shouldn't, when you grow your business, you add more people.
That's right. And so, you know, it's and we're facing some of those same issues on the micro distilling side. And interestingly, the beer distributors and wine the beer and wine wholesalers are one of the most potent political lobbies in North Carolina. And, you know, believe it or not, they're involved also in trying to quash common sense improvements to micro distilling laws as well, because they see it in their best interest to, that alcohol laws not change at all in North Carolina. They feel like they've got a good system set up and they don't want anything to change at all. And, you know, no offense to you, North Carolina beer and wine wholesalers, but there are 10 million citizens of North Carolina that would like to see something else better.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when we're talking about regulation, all kinds of stuff, there's all kinds of, and now we talk about distilling, that's a whole different can of worms.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You talk about some of the obstacles you had to face that.
I mean, for example, right, yeah. Going back to the days of when craft brewers weren't allowed to self-distribute at all, when we started this distillery, distilleries weren't allowed to sell anything that they made directly to a consumer. So we spent, as an industry, approximately 4 years, actually probably more than that, 6 years, but 4 years in the latest effort to actually get that law changed, so that starting October 1st of 2015, you had me thinking about beer in the 90s. October 1st, 2015.
You had some flashbacks to some lonely nights and some stupors.
I swear to God, I feel like I'm 100 years old right now. But, so on October 1st of 2015, distilleries were given the right to sell one bottle per person per year. And so since that time, sales in North Carolina ABC stores of North Carolina liquor brands have increased dramatically, and sales of liquor in North Carolina ABC stores have also increased dramatically. But the effort to increase distilleries' rights to sell one bottle per year of every category they make, so in my case, I make vodka, gin, moonshine, our Carolina 8 Oak whiskey, and then we make a straight wheat whiskey reserve. Right now, I can only sell you one bottle. You got to choose.
Of all those.
Right. You only get to do one bottle, period. Mm-hmm. And then the law was going to be that you could get one bottle of each thing. Mm-hmm. Well, again, the ABC boards, which is significantly different than the beer and wine wholesalers, but the ABC boards continue to fight that because they believe that somehow this is going to take away sales from them. And it just shows a fundamental misunderstanding about how people make purchases. You know, in as much as we all love alcohol, we're not putting, you know, purchasing a bottle of alcohol the number one thing on the list. You know what I mean? So when you come and visit a distillery, hey, great, I'm going to buy a couple bottles. I like this stuff. It's not like you're saying later, well, I'm not going to buy any at the ABC store because I had a chance to buy it at the distillery, right? It's not like a replacement purchase. It's more of an agritourism purchase.
Yeah.
And, you know, people in the legislature are starting to understand the power of that. The numbers themselves show that since distillers have had the right to be able to sell a bottle, that the biggest problem the ABC boards had about North Carolina spirits, which they don't sell, well, that's been addressed. But for some reason, they still don't want to expand our rights to sell because they're afraid we're somehow taking money out of their pocket, which begs the question. The state of North Carolina actually owns the system. And one of the misunderstandings is that technically, you know, in other states, Virginia and Pennsylvania, they own the stores and they run the stores. In North Carolina, we grant franchises to local boards. But the point's still the same, which is, you know, the people of North Carolina are being denied the opportunity to make choice and just do fun things. Why? Well, because of an outdated system that was built in the 30s. Now, I'm a believer in the ABC system because I grew up in California and I saw what a completely open system, the downfalls of that.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Iowa and I go home and I see rum in a gas station and it blows my mind.
That's right. Right. So I think that we can agree that they're somewhere in the middle. So my whole point is I'm not advocating for the end of the ABC system, but I am saying that the ABC system can't rely on its existing monopoly to simply not update itself and to provide consumers of North Carolina the opportunity to avail themselves of things that they want. And one of the things I've learned dealing with monopolies is that monopolies don't care about the consumer, and monopolies don't care about the producer. They care about themselves at the end of the day. Now, there are individuals in that monopoly that have the right, you know, frame of mind, But in general, and you know, faced with no competition, ultimately decisions become about what's easiest for me. You know, so in any event, it's a difficult thing that we're fighting, but we've made some great progress, and we've got some great friends in the legislature, and you know, the very first bottle of liquor sold outside of the ABC system since 1909 was sold here on October 1st, 2015. So that's that was a big moment. We sold it to Rick Gunn, sold it exactly precisely at 9 a.m., and Rick Gunn, the senator out of Alamance, was one of our best friends in the legislature in terms of getting that passed. So,
oh, that's awesome.
Very appropriate to get that done.
Yeah, that's a great story there. And that's what I find interesting about it, too, is, you know, because you take a tour, you buy it. You know what I'm saying? It's not like I take a tour of the Wonder Bread factory and I'm like, well, I'm going to go get my bread from the Wonder Bread factory.
Right.
No, I'm still going to go to the supermarket.
So thank you. I mean, like, you immediately grabbed the argument that they don't see, mm-hmm. right, which is, yeah, no, you know, I don't want to be a liquor store.
If I want your spirits, I'm not going to come here to get it.
That's
you know
right.
But if I'm taking a tour, I would like to get some.
That's right. And by the way, why is it that you can only be able to sell one bottle, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, hey, you're going to come back, you want to bring, you take a tour with your wife, your dad comes in for a visit, you're like, hey, I got this cool thing to do, right? Well, why shouldn't you be able to buy a bottle then, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and by the way, we our opponents to this tried to make this some kind of radical thing. Well, we were the 38th state in the union to allow this to happen, right? So we are on the back end of this, right? And then they say, well, yeah, there's 38 states, but we're a control state. Control states are different. Well, we are the 15th of the 17 control states to allow this to happen. And now even, you know, you're seeing that the regulations are being, you know, in Florida, they allow now a distillery to sell 4 bottles a day to each person, right? Oh. You know, why there needs to be any limitation at all, I don't know. But the point is that I think that one bottle per person per year is ridiculously strong. And I think
And how do you regulate 1 year? Like, you write somebody's information?
Oh, no. This is one of the things. We have to scan all the information, track it with our POS system. It's just ridiculous. It's, you know, and it's funny, too, because I had one opponent come up to me and say, well, you know, selling liquor is not like selling pants. You know, it takes a lot of training to make this sale. And I looked at him, I said, no offense, but, you know, it's not like we got the retail SWAT team working at the ABC system. I said, you know, I sell $3.5 million of beer and liquor and wine by the drink 10 yards off the campus of UNC. Now, that takes training. That takes skill. But selling a bottle of liquor that cannot be drank on site to somebody really isn't that hard. It's the same way we sell tobacco. It's the same way we sell it. Do you have an ID? Are you old enough? Here you go. So they always bring out this idea that somehow it's going to, you know, encourage underage drinking, or it's going to encourage some kind of, you know, parade of horribles that's going to happen. Well, we've had this law in place now for 9 months. It's been nothing but incredibly successful. There has been no downside at all. And all of this burdensome records keeping is just ridiculous, because nobody's coming to my place to buy bottles of booze instead of going to the damn ABC store, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, any event. But there are, you know, and I got to be careful here, because, you know, the ABC system is, in fact, our only retailing option. And so so we are political opponents, but at the same time, we try to find a common ground. And it has been good working as president of the Distillers Association in North Carolina with the ABC system to find those areas of common ground. One of the things that I think we're going to hopefully work together on is, currently North Carolina ABC boards are required to have a North Carolina section. Sounds like a good thing, but most distillers have come to the conclusion, as have the ABC boards, that the North Carolina section is not a good experiment, that we would prefer to be in the correct categories of whatever we are. So right now, you walk into an ABC store, you walk to the vodka section, you might see my vodka, but in most stores, I'm not there because I'm in the North Carolina section.
Yeah, and most people, and that's not
what they're thinking of.
And also, too, there's a situation of, like, some stores display it better than others.
That's right. That's right.
I've walked into a couple stores where it's up front, right mm-hmm. there at the front, like right as you walk in, there's a North Carolina section. Other times, it's like on the back side of the last row for
that's
whatever
right.
reason.
That's
like,
right. No, and then typically, in my mind, the folks that do that also then complain the North Carolina section doesn't sell. It's like, well, you know, your raspberry liqueur doesn't sell either, and that's at the same spot, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I always joke that the North Carolina section is in the middle row underneath the raspberry liqueurs, right?
Yep, that's so, actually where it is, the one place I was thinking
exactly,
of.
Exactly, right? And so my point is that I think that we all, the ABC boards, the North Carolina distillers, we would all much rather be in our corresponding sections, and then be identified as a North Carolina product. And so we're working with North Carolina Department of Agriculture, you know, to extend the Goodness Grows program through the ABC system so customers can go find the vodka, find the gin, find the whiskey where they think it's going to be, identify those that are North Carolina products. And again, you know, I'm a big believer in buying local, but I also understand that, you know, it's not like people are going to only buy stuff from North Carolina, although they could. Mm-hmm. We are making world-class spirits here, but, you know, in my mind, I just think it's an easier way. Make it easy for the consumer to make sure they know their choices.
Absolutely. But one benefit I see the ABC system, since we've already said all some of the negative, but one benefit that I really like that I've heard is that you take it all to Raleigh and they distribute it through there. It seems like if you're a smaller company and you had issues on logistics and how you're going to get your product to each one of the stores, just sending it all to Raleigh makes sense. Was it that way for you? Do you see that as a positive, or is there some hang-ups in that?
Well, I see it as a positive, but it'd be the same way. If I had a distributor, mm-hmm. you know, in other states, I have distributors.
Okay,
I send it all to the distributor.
It'd be no different.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right. I think the big thing is that the going back to the idea that one of the other distinctions that I see between beer and liquor is that at some point distributors, mm-hmm. so, you know, you got the three-tier distribution market. You got the manufacturer, you got the distributor, and you got the retailer. At some point, the distributor in beer realized this is our vested interest to promote local and craft beers. Well, in liquor, the distributor and the retailer is collapsed, and that's the state of North Carolina. And to ensure there's no favoritism or whatever, there's all these rules that say that you know, the ABC board can't talk about spirits or push spirits or say anything. And so I think that I understand why those rules came about. They don't want favoritism, they don't want all this kind of stuff. But the problem is that the distributors on the liquor side are never going to play a role for craft spirits like the distributors played a role for craft beer. Mm-hmm. And that is unfortunately to the detriment. Now, there are exceptions. There are boards that, you know, here in Orange County, for example, they've got an incredible local section that puts it on display. But, you know, from a systemic perspective, I'm not so sure that's ever going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, as far as, I mean, the way the system's set up right now, but you've obviously been growing and things have been pushing forward. What are some things we can look forward to in the future for the distillery here?
Well, for Topo, you know, we're getting ready to release our straight wheat whiskey. So a little primer on that, you know, to be a straight, well, let me back up even farther.
No, please.
Right,
back
okay.
up as far as...
It,
back in the 1800s.
Well, then let's go back really far.
Yeah.
One of the fallacies, I think, when we talk about American whiskey, one of the deep-rooted fallacies is this idea that bourbon is the only or the best expression of American whiskey. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people are surprised to find out there's actually six American whiskeys. There's bourbon, there is rye, there is what we make, which is wheat whiskey. There's malted rye, which I've never seen. There's corn whiskey, and there is malt whiskey, which is our version of scotch. Mm-hmm. So what's fascinating is that people have seized upon bourbon. I mean, bourbon is 90% of the market share.
But everybody's taking a tour in Kentucky, and they told you that bourbon's the only American whiskey.
Exactly. And there was a congressional declaration passed in 1961 declaring bourbon the American spirit or whatever, right? It was just marketing fluff, but the bourbon manufacturers have taken that and turned it into, people don't realize there's anything other than bourbon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, you look back at history, prior to the Civil War, bourbon was considered rot gut. And so back before the Civil War, rye was 70% of the market share. Bourbon was the low 10 to 15% of the market share. Mm-hmm. And then the last 10, the high part, 10, 15%, was actually wheat whiskey. And that's what we make. So after the Civil War, everybody's broke. And, you know, there is no Xanax, there is no Ambien, let alone aspirin. And so these guys are coming back. I can only imagine the PTSD and all that stuff. They've got literally no medicine at all. What's the only thing to medicate themselves with? Right? Cheap whiskey. Yeah. And that cheap whiskey was bourbon. Why was bourbon cheap? Well, it comes from corn. What is the definition of bourbon? Bourbon has to be at least 51% corn or more in the mash. So then that begs the question, why wasn't it just straight corn whiskey? Well, people that have had straight corn whiskey, typically, there are exceptions, some people enjoy it, but most people agree that straight corn whiskey makes a really rough not good tasting spirit. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced, all marketing and hoo-ha from the bourbon guys aside, I'm convinced bourbon comes about because the Scotch Irish are in Appalachia back in the 1790s or so, and they've got all this excess corn, and they try to convert it into a shelf-stable thing to get it to market. They're used to making, you know, whiskey out of malt. They're like, fine, we can make whiskey out of corn. They make 100% corn whiskey, and they realize, you know, it doesn't taste good. So they say, well, let's blend it with some other grains in order to kind of smooth it out. And that's where I think bourbon is born, that bourbon is this utilization of corn, and 100% of it was an awful tasting spirit, so they blend it with other grains like rye, like wheat, to make it palatable. That's where bourbon comes from, not that it was this incredible thing in and of itself. And again, it wasn't considered premium at all until after the Civil War, because in 1858, again, 15% of the market share was about bourbon. 1868, that market share was 90%, right? So bourbon explodes. Rye whiskey is relegated to 10% of the market share, and wheat whiskey stops getting made in the United States until ourselves and a couple guys out west start bringing it back. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people will say to me all the time, well, I drink bourbon because my great-great-granddaddy drank bourbon. And I say, well, you should drink wheat whiskey because that's what your great-great-granddaddy would have drank if he'd had any money, mm-hmm. right? And yeah. So why, you know, what's the difference between wheat and rye and bourbon? Well, first of all, right off the bat, most bourbons, you know, in terms of mainstream bourbons that are considered smooth, your Maker's Marks, your Woodfords, et cetera, those are what we call wheated bourbons. So what that means is, yes, they're bourbons because they're at least 51% corn, but a wheated bourbon means that the second largest ingredient is wheat. And so wheat makes a clean, light, sweet spirit that sort of leavens out or sort of smooths out the roughness of the corn and makes a very palatable spirit. And so we were like, well, let's just cut out the corn altogether. And so as far as we know, we're the only 100% wheat mash bill whiskey in the United States. Very, very smooth. Very, you know, it's got elements of being a bourbon. It's got elements of you know, being a Scotch. I think its closest thing, though, is kind of an Irish whiskey. It's very, very light, very smooth. And I think it's a very, to me, it's a superior product. And so we make this in two different ways. So by the way, you have to be an American whiskey, you have to be aged in a new charred American oak barrel. Well, why a new charred American oak barrel? Because the lobbyists for the barrel union in 1939 got that passed in the Fair Act bill that was going through under Roosevelt. And so there is no inherent quality aspect to the American white oak. It was more about keeping jobs in America, which is fine. But people have forgotten that history, right? Mm-hmm. But in order to be an American whiskey, you have to be aged in an American white oak barrel, a new charred American white oak barrel. And then if you're aged in that barrel for over 2 years, you're then considered a straight. And so we're coming out with our straight wheat whiskey. I will put that against any whiskey you've ever had. That'll be coming out this year. It'll be $79 a bottle. Our 8-oak whiskey, we don't call that a wheat whiskey. We call it our 8-oak whiskey. Why? Because we didn't age it in a barrel. Mm-hmm. We're aging it with chips. And that's one of the things that, you know, the big boys started experimenting how to carve off a couple of years for their aging to be able to supply the Asian market with bourbon. And so they experimented putting chips in the barrel. Those experiments went so well that smaller distillers said, well, geez, why do we need barrels at all? And so they started making whiskey using chips. And you can't call it bourbon, but for our purposes, let's call it chip bourbon. I was late to the chip game because every chip bourbon I had sucked. And I thought to myself, you know, why would I make this? This doesn't taste good. I thought there was something wrong with the chips. But one of the things we do when we do tastings, we taste our unaged moonshine whiskey versus corn whiskey to show people the difference. And it wasn't until I was doing that for about the 1,000th time that I realized that the reason why chip bourbon sucked was that the bourbon itself had not been given enough time to get smooth. And that you have to age bourbon to make it smooth. In our case, our wheat whiskey is coming off the still smooth. It doesn't need to be aged to be smooth. It only needs to be aged to get wood flavor. And so we started experimenting with chips. And then we said, well, we're not going to get credit for being in a barrel anyways. Let's take a look at other woods. And so we incorporated back in some French oak. And that's why we call it 8-oak, because there's 8 different variations of 3 different oaks, 2 different types of French and 1, you know, the American white oak, in different toasts and chars. and it makes a fantastic whiskey. We're able to make it much faster than aging it in a barrel. So it takes us about 4 months for that process, and I'll put it up against any bourbon under $50. And that's going over quite well. It's 100% up this year here in North Carolina. People are realizing that's a great whiskey and it's a great value. And so it's kind of fun to, it's not just as simple as putting chips in a tea bag and sticking it in the tank. We do a lot of other things with oxygen and all kinds of stuff. But, I'm a big believer in convention and understanding where an industry has come from. But I also believe that every generation needs to expand the craft and generate new ways to move forward. And so I'm proud of some of the lack of a better term, cutting-edge stuff we're doing in our distillery as well.
Absolutely. Well, we've come kind of towards the end. So we get to the point, the million-dollar question. Basically, I do this whole podcast just to get this one question right here.
Uh-oh.
So be prepared. It's the idea
of Calvin Coolidge.
Nailed it. We're done. Goodbye. didn't even need to phone a friend. it's the idea of success. You as an individual, you've done so many things, and you've had a clear, you've had to figure out what you want out of life and stuff like that. But the idea that always pops in my head about myself and things that I want is success. Is it something that's attainable? Do you feel like you'll be happy when you get it? Do you have a clear idea what it is? Do you have a dollar sign amount attached to it? Like, when I say the word success, and how does that relate to you in your life?
Well, I think that is a very important question that I've thought a lot about since the recession. So I think that prior to 2009, I probably would have given a very different answer than I'm giving now. But in 2009, the recession hit the restaurant industry really hard here in Chapel Hill. And it was the same time that I was trying to start the distillery and buy this building and all of this stuff. So there were so many hard years just trying to stay in business. And so I teach entrepreneurship. I do a bunch of stuff. And I remember at one point in my life being that, success was equated to a dollar figure. There's a part of me now that says, success is, are you open for another day, right? I mean, did you somehow figure out a way to open another day? And not to get too political, but boy, my whole industry has changed, good, bad, or otherwise. Obamacare completely overhauled my restaurant business because I have 150 employees at that restaurant. So I had to provide Obamacare and all that, which is fine. But the interesting thing is that, the idea in my mind, they're no longer... there can't be tipped employees, for example, right? I had to create a whole new system. And so now all the employees have to give their money in every shift, and I got to cut it on checks, so I've got the money to pay for their Obamacare. So my point is that it's becoming harder and harder for the small business person to actually survive. So on one level, hey, are you around to answer the bell the next morning? That is one level. But I think that the bigger definition of success, because the other thing that's happened is I've had three kids since 2009, and I think that success, first of all, is not a place. It is a moment. And, you need to enjoy those feelings of peace that come from doing something well, and the peace that comes from feeling like you've created friends and family that you enjoy being with. And I know that sounds kind of platitude-y, but I think that's really what it comes down to, because in some level, all of this is an illusion. Right, and the only thing that's real is your family and your friends. And having said that, I would like to be able to send my kids to college.
There's still a dollar amount.
There's a minimum dollar amount. How's that sound?
That fluctuates year to year.
I don't need a lot, but
somebody else does right now. Well, Scott, before we get out of here, you have a live microphone to let everybody know anything that you need them to know about the distillery, the restaurant, the brewery, everything else. Please spit it out there into the world.
Well, hey, we hope that if you come to Chapel Hill, you're going to swing by Top of the Hill Restaurant and Brewery and you can go online to topodistillery.com, sign up for a tour of the distillery. When you go to your ABC store, and Topo is in basically every North Carolina ABC store now, look for us. If you don't see us where you think we should be, see if we're in the North Carolina section there. But we appreciate people's support, and we see that our sales are growing. So there are a lot of folks out there that are enjoying our product, and we sure appreciate your support. And hopefully I'll see you up at the restaurant or at the distillery.
All right. Well, Scott, thank you very much for taking time out of your very busy day to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, buddy, getting to know you and everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been a DSCT.TV production.